Coming up on today's program, preserving, protecting, and repurposing the land we live on. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. As always, thanks for sharing your weekend with WISO. We've got lots coming your way in the next half hour. Our first story today comes from our colleagues at the Ohio Newsroom. Today, ecologists have been transforming a Southwest Ohio nuclear site into a nature preserve for 2 decades and using a slimy barometer to track their progress.
Support comes from the James at Ohio State. Cancer. For some, it's one of life's fiercest foes, but not at the James, where a team of nearly 300 specialists and over 1,500 researchers are working together to create a cancer-free world.
I'm Claire Roth. 21 years ago this spring, the Ohio EPA and others were working to transform the former Fernald Uranium Processing Facility in Southwest Ohio into a nature preserve. The site cleanup was nearing the finish line, and scientists were eyeing one key indicator to see if the wetlands they had built were working.
Salamanders are a sign of an established wetland, usually, and in this case would show that we've put a wetland in a location where salamanders need additional breeding habitat.
That was then team leader Tom Schneider speaking with Tana Weingartner of the Ohio Newsroom member station WVXU in 2005. She picks up the story from there.
It was a cold, windy day in late March 2005 when I joined Schneider and other specialists at Fernald to search for salamanders in the man-made wetlands. Their presence would be a sign the land was healing from its Cold War-era scars when employees spent nearly 40 years producing uranium metal for nuclear weapons. Team members were hopeful.
And we have high hopes.
Well, we're looking forward to the day when we get the site cleaned up and it can be like a land lab environmental education facility where folks can bring kids out here and do environmental education on the importance of wetlands. And, you know, it's going to make a great contrast with what used to be here and the environmental contamination with, you know, the environmental benefit that the facility is providing down the road.
We didn't find any salamanders that day, but 21 years later, interpreter Luke Teese gives tours of those same wetlands.
This is our main vernal pool. That is probably our most populous salamander location. And look in the water, you'll see the egg sacs on the edge of the water. Little jelly-like egg sacs.
Teese says 2 years ago, the preserve did a survey and captured 90 spotted salamanders in this vernal pool.
Which is huge. Previously, I think their best they said was like 15.
Fernald will always carry the signs of its past. The most obvious is the giant on-site disposal mound containing about 3 million cubic yards of low-grade contaminated waste. Teese doesn't shy away from that fact when giving tours.
Has anyone here never been to Fernald at all before?
Well, we grew up around here, but we've always been afraid.
And that's the thing. There's a stigma against the site for the history of it. And I want to let you know that it, even though that is a low-grade radioactive waste storage facility, it is perfectly safe.
There are also groundwater extraction wells that are flushing out the remaining plumes of uranium. But alongside those wells, there's everything from beavers to bobcats, frogs to salamanders, and even species that are under threat, like the Blanchard's cricket frog and rare birds. Jeff Davis is a herpetologist that consults on endangered amphibians and reptiles for the state. He monitored salamander populations at Fernald for decades. Now he comes for the scenery.
You would look out and see all of these just industrial buildings, and to see that gone now, and for me to come out here with my buddies and go bird watching, and to see short-eared owls flying around, and I think one day, I want to say we counted 12 species of ducks and geese on some of the lakes. It's incredible.
From a Superfund site no one wanted in their backyard to that living lab environmentalists imagined, Fernald now stands as a testament to those high hopes for the future. For the Ohio Newsroom, I'm Tana Weingartner.
Support comes from Ohio CASA, CASA volunteers are everyday Ohioans who advocate for thousands of children experiencing abuse or neglect, giving them a voice in court. Learn more at ohiocasa.org.
That's all today from the Ohio Newsroom. We'll talk with you tomorrow.
Check out more from the Ohio Newsroom on our website at wyso.org. Up next, well, sometimes preserving a parcel of land simply means giving it to someone else. About a decade ago, the city of Springfield started a program to cut down on the number of vacant lots peppering its neighborhoods. It's called the Mow to Own program, and it's just what it says. Residents can mow a vacant or abandoned parcel of land for the season, and then the city will give them the property. Kim Foltz is the code compliance manager for Springfield. She spoke about how the program works, calling it a win-win for neighbors and the city.
Typically, these properties, they've gone through a tax foreclosure, and they've just been sitting unused for long periods of time. Any property owner that lives within 1,000 feet of the lot can apply for the program. They just need to be current on city income taxes, property taxes, and have had no code compliance violations within a 36-month period. There is a $134 deposit. From there, they maintain the lot for a 7-month period, essentially a mowing season. And then we move forward with getting the ownership transferred.
How has that program been working out?
It's been great. The impact has been really strong. Since the program started in 2016, we've returned 228 vacant properties back to productive use across the community. In the few years, we've had steady participation, 21 parcels in 2023, 16 parcels in 2024. 11 in 2025, and so far in 2026, we've already have 6 parcels in the process of Mow to Own. It's encouraging to see residents take advantage of the program and invest in their neighborhoods.
Yeah, and so are these full lots that people can build on?
Residents could potentially build on them. They would have to get with building regulations and zoning to see setbacks, requirements, for the whole process, but it is a possibility.
Where are the majority of these lots?
The lots are actually scattered all over. There's a lot in the southern portion of the city, the western. There's even some in the north, probably less concentrated. Some situations could be where someone owned a piece of land and maybe they passed away and there was no estate and it just sat there abandoned. So they really are scattered all over the city.
And these definitely are properties with no housing on them, correct?
Yes. Yes, they must be free from structures.
Talk about the overall impact when someone decides to take care of this property. I mean, it really can change the face of a neighborhood.
Absolutely. One impact, it reduces the number of lots that the city needs to mow and maintain. Another wonderful thing about it, it reduces the blight you often see on neglected vacant lots throughout the city, and it leads to cleaner, more vibrant neighborhoods.
Is there anything else that you want to want our listeners to know about the program?
I would say, you know, the program, it's really a win-win program. It does put the vacant lots back into productive use. It strengthens neighborhoods. If a person obtains a lot that is next to their home, they can combine the parcels. Kind of mentioned expanding their yard area. They might be able to install a fence, build a garage on this lot, a pool. There's a lot of options. Some people put gardens up in these spaces. It's a great program. Anyone interested in the program, they can learn more by visiting the city's website, which is springfieldohio.gov. And they just go to the code compliance page and we have the applications, frequently asked questions, all the information laid out there.
Kim Foltz with the City of Springfield. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks so much for joining us. Cleveland Cliffs is changing course from its plan to decarbonize its Middletown steelworks using hydrogen. Now the manufacturer has applied for an air permit to prolong its fossil fuel burning future for the next few decades. It hopes to pay for the project with hundreds of millions of public dollars. WISO's environment reporter Adriana Martinez-Smiley is following the issue.
2 years ago, Cleveland Cliffs unveiled plans for an ambitious transformation at its Middletown steel mill using over $500 million in Inflation Reduction Act funds. The plan was to swap the plant's coal and coke-fired blast furnaces it uses to make steel with 100% electric furnaces fueled by hydrogen. The project served as a bellwether for the Biden administration's industrial demonstrations program. It sought to convince factories to decarbonize. Then Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm toured the Middletown plant for the announcement in 2024. She said they wanted the changes there to be replicated across the country.
We don't want to just make the best products in the world, and we will. We want to make sure that we make the best and cleanest products in the world.
Cliffs once estimated this project would reduce 1 million tons of greenhouse gas emissions annually and add 170 jobs. And community members celebrated the expected health and quality of life improvements. But once President Trump started his second term, government leaders retreated from federal investments in climate change mitigation. Many of the plans for U.S. hydrogen generation went offline. In an earnings call last summer, Cliff CEO Lorenzo Gonzalez described to shareholders the company's plans to pivot.
It's not like that project was canceled by the DOE, because it was not. We informed the DOE that we would not be pursuing that project. What generated a very good conversation with the current DOEs on revamping that project in a way that we preserve and enhance Middletown using beautiful coal, beautiful coke, beautiful natural gas.
Then Cleveland Cliffs submitted a new air permit in February that cements the hydrogen project as a distant memory. WISO obtained the application submitted to the Southwest Ohio Air Quality Agency. It calls for refurbishing the 73-year-old No. 3 blast furnace. Ariana Christie works with Industrious Labs, a nonprofit focused on decarbonizing heavy industry. She says this proposal will give a pollution-burdened community more of the same problems.
So this project will extend the life of this furnace well into the 2040s at a time when global steelmakers are increasingly beginning to move away from coal-based steelmaking.
Cliffs also wants to install a cogeneration plant. Christie says that would capture excess gas from steelmaking to generate steam and electricity to partially power the mill.
So it makes the existing dirty coal-based steelmaking process somewhat less wasteful, but it actually does nothing to reduce the carbon and health-harming pollution that's the central problem in coal-based iron making.
Southwest Ohio clean air advocate Marilyn Wall says she, along with a Middletown resident, are trying to notify neighbors of the plan.
You know, I think part of what is really challenging for the community is that it's a really complicated application, and it's hard to figure out what exactly they're doing and how much difference this would be.
Refurbishing the furnace will likely cost hundreds of millions of dollars. Based on the Cliff CEO's comments last year, Ian Wells, an organizer with the Natural Resources Defense Council, says,
yeah, I mean, there's a chance that they've attempted to rescope the project, that they're still planning to use funding under the Industrial Demonstrations Project, but for a different purpose. And I think the challenge that we have is we just don't know if that public money is still being used, and if so, how it's being used.
The viability of this project might be contingent on this rescoping. In Cliff's most recent earnings call from April 20th, Gonzalez said,
our Middletown Works project has received clear affirmation that the project will proceed once the updated scope is finally approved, and we are now in the final stages of completing that work.
It's also not clear if the company is allowed to repurpose that $500 million grant. The U.S. Department of Energy and Cleveland Cliffs didn't respond to WISO's multiple requests for comment. Christie says Cleveland Cliffs doesn't have a lot of cash on hand, and that means the community could influence the outcome.
Pushback, advocacy, things that slow this project down all shift the calculus for the company away from supporting a relining at this facility.
The Ohio EPA hasn't made a decision on the application, But the agency says there will be a 30-day public comment period once a draft permit is available. And it can schedule a public hearing on that draft permit if there's enough public interest. For WYSO News, I'm Adriana Martinez-Smiley.
Up next on WYSO Weekend, this week on Translucent, Lee Wade highlights an Ohio-based nonprofit working statewide to support the rights and visibility of trans and gender-diverse people.
Across Ohio, policies targeting transgender people are changing fast, from healthcare to legal documents to how gender is even defined in state law. And while all of that is happening at the State House, there are small, community-led organizations working in real time to help people figure out what it means for them. One of them is Trans Ohio.
We're not a large organization. Like, I talk to folks every day that think that we're like a large agency. And I'm like, we have had 1.5 staff people for the past year. And before that, we're all volunteers. And it's really just a testament to how much hyper-focused and very committed trans people can accomplish.
That's Dara Atkison, Executive Director of Trans Ohio. It's a trans-led statewide organization that's been around for over 2 decades, but it still operates more like a grassroots network than a large nonprofit. No big infrastructure, no massive staff, just a small group of people figuring out how to meet the needs of their community.
I think what you're seeing in the last couple of years is we've really been meeting this moment by expanding a couple of things that we've always done. We've always done some mutual aid. You know, it used to be we'd help 4 or 5 people a month with like emergency housing situations, you know, abusive partners, that kind of thing. But scaling that to, we're very close to $200,000 of mutual aid out in the last 2 years. You know, same for our legal services, that our name change clinic is a little over 10 years old. But in the last 2 years, we've scaled those services considerably and are very proud of just how many people we've helped with updating their legal documents.
Trans Ohio also runs legal clinics, helping people update their names and identity documents, something that can make a big difference in everyday life. But as those services expand, so does uncertainty about what comes next.
There's so many things being proposed in other states that we have a lot of people terrified of that are targeted towards adults. We, of course, have our budget language floating out there from last year. You know, Ohio did choose in our state budget, of all things, to change all of the revised code to contain a binary sex definition. So different agencies can change their internal policies to reflect that if they choose. You know, that wouldn't mean that every ID in Ohio could be invalidated without passing a new law. We would absolutely need a new law for that, you know, if we were to go a Kansas route. But if the BMV wanted to stop us from updating our gender markers, they would only need to change their internal policies. And so that kind of thing is scary and just kind of floating out there. And so we've been working on lots of phrasing for the harm reduction and contingencies to communicate to the community if any number of bad situations with our IDs or healthcare transpire.
For a lot of people, that uncertainty is already showing up in real ways. And whether your ID matches who you are, whether you can access care, and how safe you feel just moving through the world. And while those questions are still up in the air, Trans Ohio is trying to make sure people aren't navigating them alone.
The message of hope is that a few trans people can accomplish a ton. If I walk into any trans event in the state and I say, give me a show of hands, who has been helped in some way by Trans Ohio, you're going to get some hands. And that is a really cool place to be in for a small trans group. But it really is a staple to, if you think there's something the community needs, like, make it happen.
Trans Ohio is a small group, but their impact is already being felt across the state. Thank you, Trans Ohio, for the work that you do. I'm Lee Wade, and thank you for listening to Translucent.
Find more from our Translucent series online at WYSO.org. Translucent is supported by the Ruby Girls Foundation and Square One Salon and Spa, and produced right here at the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices at WYSO, as is Blue Skies and Tailwinds. This week, UNESCO World Heritage Sites are special places around the world that are recognized for their outstanding cultural or natural importance. These sites are officially protected under an international agreement called the World Heritage Convention. In Ohio, several places have received this recognition. There is an interesting connection between how some of these sites were identified through early aerial photography and the work done at McCook Field and Wright Field. Dan Patterson has the story.
The relationship between early flight and photography started with Orville Wright. The very clear images of their experiments proved visually what they invented. Almost as soon as one of their airplanes could carry a passenger, local photographer William Mayfield was flying with a large camera. Orville wrote about what he saw, that once in the air, the world beneath sank away, changing familiar scenes like fields and fences into a miniature white ball on a green billiard cloth. As airplanes became more commonplace and important tools for the military, cameras and photographers were included. World War I flying started with airplanes as reconnaissance, so the generals could see what was beyond the horizon. Aerial mapping left behind a stunning visual and permanent record of not only the war, but the landscapes across Europe. These images provide rich and valuable information for historians over a century later. One of the many specialties at the newly formed Army Air Engineering Headquarters was the aerial photography and mapping. The lessons learned over Europe were brought back to Ohio. The time of day could reveal in the aerial images a vast new perspective. Highlights and shadows, almost imperceptible at midday, came to life. A veteran of the Great War, Lieutenant Dash Reeves, who received the Distinguished Service Cross and a Silver Star for his efforts making essential images in 1918 at the end of the Meuse-Argonne Offensive, which was crucial in bringing the war to a conclusion, continued his photographic services and enhanced the skills necessary to better interpret the photos from above. In 1923, he patented a device for interpreting aerial photography, and in 1927, his book, Aerial Photographs, Characteristics, and Military Applications, was published. It turns out that Reeves had a personal interest in archaeology and was able to combine that interest with his experience and knowledge of looking at the world from above. Ohio was rich with regions to study. He started working with the Ohio Historical Society and carried out an aerial survey of the ancient mounds and fortifications in Ohio. In the mid-1930s, the Ohio History Journal published his article, A Newly Discovered Extension of the Newark Works. Reeves' uses of aerial imaging, which he learned in World War I and expanded while flying from McCook and Wright Fields, identified where these sites are located, which then directed expert archaeologists to learn and gather new knowledge with more traditional tools and time-honored techniques with shovels, spades, and sifting through the soil. His images and article about the Great Serpent Mound was published in Scientific American in 1936. Serpent Mound has long been an Ohio State Park where all of us can marvel at the sculpture in the ground created thousands of years ago. The technology now includes ground-penetrating radar, which only reinforces the images made by Reeves nearly 100 years ago. The Hopewell Ceremonial Earthworks join more than 1,100 other important places on this distinguished list. It is the first and only UNESCO site in the state of Ohio. Orville Wright led the way. He wrote, "Viewed from above, the flat, monotonous landscapes take on a new beauty not seen from the ground. The plowed fields, the patches of grass and grain, and the wooded spots appear as a quilt of beautiful colors." For WYSO, this is Dan Patterson, wishing you blue skies and tailwinds.
Blue Skies and Tailwinds is sponsored by Sinclair Community College. This is WYSO Weekend.
This is Bird Note. Peer into the world of birds, and eyes of many different colors peer back. There are shades of light and dark, yellows, whites, greens, the red eyes of certain hawks, ducks, loons, herons, and songbirds. These colors really pop because birds have no white around the iris like we do. So the yellow eyes of a great horned owl or a herring gull seem to give the birds a fierce, penetrating glare. While eye color isn't tied to one group of birds or another, a pattern common to many birds is a change in eye color as immature birds grow to adulthood. Bald eagles, ring-billed gulls, ducks such as goldeneye and scalp have brown eyes as youngsters and yellow as adults. Red-tailed hawks reverse this pattern, with their eyes changing from yellow to brown, while the yellow eyes of a young Cooper's hawk turn deep red as it reaches maturity. Not all birds' eyes change color as the birds age. But for those whose eye color appears to signal adulthood, this is likely an adaptation that helps them gauge the maturity and suitability of potential mates. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann. BirdNote gives you the sounds of birds every day, and you get the sights as well when you follow us on Instagram at BirdNote Radio.
BirdNote, putting another bookend to our program. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks so much for tuning in. Always remember, this program is available as a podcast. You can download and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Our theme music, Another Beautiful Day in Paradise, was provided by Magnolia Bolthead. Tune in again next weekend. We'll have more conversations and highlights for you then.